emotional intelligence is not a skill you need when your life is perfect and when your relationships are firing on all cylinders. It is absolutely the skill set you need in those uncomfortable, inconvenient, and challenging moments of your lives. We have access to all of the words in the English language to use free of charge. But if we're not using our words mindfully, they can cost us a lot. Every experience, every interaction we have is literally happening in the streets of our lives every day. And what are we carrying in our emotional backpacks to ensure that we're not just surviving, but we're thriving?
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, it creates something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Sylvia Bafour. Sylvia is a keynote speaker on emotional intelligence and has worked with 460 major corporations to help them better connect with their teams and customers. She was also voted one of the top 15 female inspirational speakers alongside Mel Robbins and Oprah. Now, Sylvia's journey was already pretty cool and inspiring, but it was a chance meeting with writer and activist Dr. Maya Angelou that launched a lifelong relationship that shaped her life. We dig into what emotional intelligence is and what leaders need to do better if they really care about the culture they're building. But probably my favorite takeaway is the power of curiosity. This conversation really stayed with me. One of my favorites so far. So please enjoy Sylvia Bafour. Okay, welcome, Sylvia Bafour. I can't tell you how excited I am for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a long time.
Yeah, I'm very much excited to be with you, and hopefully your listeners will get something fun out of this.
Before we get started, I just wanted to share a brief story about how we met. You and I had crossed paths at a bit of a conference. As often happens at the end of day one, a bunch of us went out to dinner and we ended up sitting across from one another at the end of one of these long tables. I don't know if you've ever this has happened to you, but over the course of the conversation, it came up that you were mentored by Dr. Maya Angelou for over a dozen years. You had mentioned, not in any sort of bragging way, I don't remember how it came up, about being listed on the top 15 of female inspirational speakers alongside people like Mel Robbins and Oprah. And during the course of the conversation, it slowly started to occur to me that you were kind of a big deal. You know, when names like Maya Angelou and Oprah come up, it tends to cut through the dinner chit chat. It's almost like the band stopped playing and everybody at this table starts turning towards you as you recount these stories of some of the things you've done. So that struck me. It also struck me as I reflected on that later that if I had known that, I might have been intimidated and afraid to actually sit across from you. But the most important thing that struck me about that is that at the end of that conversation, you offered to support or help me out in any way. And there was something about that offer that was so genuine. You know, when Amy and I, my producer Amy, and I were putting together the idea for this podcast, I made a list of people that I wanted on. You were at the one of the very first names that I jotted down. And it took me a little while to muster up the courage to ask you. But you've been just so gracious and generous with your time and your insights. And I'll never forget that dinner and your offer to help, which is essentially what led us to here. So I guess that's my very long-winded way of saying I'm extremely grateful for this and really excited about it.
Well, and thank you for those kind words. It's flattering, but also reassuring because it reminds me that my parents did the best they could. And hopefully that's showing, you know, as I move through this world.
Yeah. I'm really excited to talk about a few things. Certainly your work on emotional intelligence and leaders with big companies around the world. I'm really excited to dig into that. But I've got to ask about a bit of your journey first off. You were born in Ghana. You've lived in 8 countries. You speak 5 languages. And I think I read that, you know, when you were little, you dreamed of being a professional tourist. And I don't know whether you made that term up because I had never heard it before, but it kind of seems like that dream came true. And I'm just wondering where that came from. Did you always have that ever since you were a little girl?
Yeah. You know, I'm smiling, Bob, because my mother every so often reminds me of that goal that I had when she asked me. I think I was about 6 years old at the time. You know, I would say that it comes really from my father. I'm so sorry that the world has been deprived of his presence for the last 21 years, but he was the most, one of the most emotionally intelligent human beings I've ever met. And as a result of his emotional intelligence, the impact that he had on people was such that people were constantly looking out for him. You know, everywhere in the world he would go, people were always thinking of Eric Balfour and the opportunities that they could essentially create for him in other organizations in different parts of the world. And so we became globetrotters because of my father's emotional intelligence and the presence he had, the impact, his reputation preceded him. And so we got the chance as a result to just travel the world because those opportunities happened to be spread out in different parts.
So I'm curious what you think those early experiences, when you look back on them, the impact that those had on you and whether there was something in there that almost predestined you to be working in this field of emotional intelligence.
I mean, I know for a fact that having traveled and lived in many parts of the world allowed me a unique lens into other people's worlds, right? And it connects with the idea that fundamentally, we all have a desire to be understood and seen. And so the more I had an opportunity to understand people and their way of living and their way of thinking in different parts of the world, the better I was able to connect, right? Because when people feel understood and seen, even in moments when we're disagreeing with them, they open up their world to you and just connect more deeply, which then translates for me to the stage when I'm presenting a keynote, that it, no matter who's sitting in my audience, it's in my blood to present my ideas in a way that allows you to connect with them, relate to them, experience and receive them without ego. We don't mix with people who are different from us and bring our egos to the table and expect to create meaningful connections, you know? So I don't know if I appreciated as much when I was a little girl traveling so much, right? But now I look back and I'm so grateful that we did travel as much as we did.
Well, yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about it is as a child, that's the only life you know. And it's only after you become a little bit older, you look back and go, oh, wow, that was different than most people experiences. And it gives me a unique set of talents that a lot of people don't have. And everybody's got that, just that yours just seem to be a little bit more dramatic and pronounced than most. So one of the things that you mentioned when we met is that you were mentored by Dr. Maya Angelou, the acclaimed poet, civil rights activist, author, speaker. And I'd love to know how that came about. How did you meet her?
I met her about 22 years ago while I was waiting tables at mouth-watering restaurant in Washington, D.C. called B. Smith's. And in the last couple decades of her life, I know for sure that she didn't fly. She didn't like flying, so she would travel everywhere by bus or by train. And she had a home in Harlem and one in Winston-Salem. And so she would go sort of back and forth between Harlem and Winston-Salem via Amtrak. And so B. Smith's, which was right in Union Station, was a convenient stop for her. And one day she just happened to be in the cigar bar enjoying a martini and some red beans and rice. And my friend was bartending. And so I begged her to introduce me to her. I just wanted to say hi and get back to the business of what I was doing, waiting tables. In typical Maya Angelou fashion, she wanted to know a lot more about me and what my aspirations were beyond waiting tables. And then she invited me to Thanksgiving at her home that year in Winston-Salem. And then, of course, the next 12 or so Thanksgivings, I got a chance to be with her family, much to the chagrin of my own family. You know, I was never around during Thanksgivings because I was always in Winston-Salem. You know, we had lots of celebrities coming and going through B. Smith's, from Catherine Zeta-Jones to Michael Douglas, and you name them all. But Maya Angelou just had a distinct ability to see your humanity and make you feel seen, you know, and it just speaks to, you know, who she was. Yeah. And she had this obsession with never wanting anybody to be elevated on a pedestal. So during Thanksgivings, it was remarkable to see how all the celebrities in the room, because she'd have a few of them, whether it was, you know, Spielberg or Quincy Jones the first year I went, or Oprah or some of the others. And she had a remarkable ability to make them all feel the same as us, the ordinary people. It's almost like they could, I use the word smell themselves, right? It's like you sit there and you are human, just like the next person who doesn't have the bank account and the fame that you have. Mm. And she didn't have a tolerance for people elevating themselves above others, because she had this desire to ensure that the kids coming behind us had something to aspire to. And it wasn't just everybody is on a pedestal and looking special and unattainable. It just showed, and she lived out what she believed. You know, she didn't speak out of one side of her mouth and then act a different way. She was just, she was amazing in that way. So long story short, that's really how I came to be connected with her. And I had no idea that morning when I was going to wait tables that I would leave with an invitation to spend Thanksgiving with her and be mentored by her, you know, for the subsequent years after.
And to your credit, you said yes to that. So it's funny how sometimes these opportunities get presented to us and we say yes. Sometimes they're small. Sometimes they're like getting invited to Maya Angelou's house for Thanksgiving and you realize this is a monumental occasion. But I'm sure even then you couldn't have really appreciated the impact that would have.
No, I couldn't have. No, absolutely not. I still can't appreciate it. And it's, you know, she's been gone, since 2014. Instead of lamenting, you know, I think to myself, I'm at a point in my life where her and I would just have, like, you know, you think about how she tried to help me for 12 years, but I was also, I often say, at the right place at the wrong time of my life, you know, to really take full advantage of the connection we had. And I look back now with more clarity about my life and my path and just how much more she would have added to that. But then I sit back in gratitude and say not many had the privilege of 12, 13 years, you know, of time with her. So that's what I'm going to hang on to, you know, and think, what would Maya Angelou do as I move forward in my life?
For sure. So you've called her a mentor, and this is something I've spent a little bit of time too talking to other leaders about. What does that term mean to you? Because I imagine there are people in your life that call you a mentor. How has that experience with Maya Angelou kind of shaped the relationships that you have with people that you help along the way?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I also think often about the idea of mentorship. And for me, I see it as someone who believes in you oftentimes more than you believe in yourself, you know, and somebody who is rooting for your rise and speaking your name in rooms that you're not in. And as a result of the mentorship I got from Maya Angelou, I actually had a chance to exercise this a few years ago when I came off stage and I was speaking to senior students. They were getting ready to go to college. And there was an African contingent. So it's a room of like 180 international students who had convened in America for a one-year course. And when I was done speaking, I could tell the Kenyan students, the Ghanaian students, you know, all sort of gravitated towards me at the end. And two girls in particular, one from South Africa and one from Ghana, came up and had the courage to say, hey, you know, would you mind being our mentor? And, you know, I told them how flattered I was by the request. But I said to them, look, you know, you're 18 years old at the moment. I'm pretty sure that you don't yet know how I can help you in your life. You aren't at a point where you have the clarity of how you can best leverage my guidance and mentorship. And so what I want you to do is hold on to my contact information. There will come a time in the next couple of years when you will know exactly how I can help you. And I want you to pick up that contact information and reach out to me. And then we can hit the ground running. Because oftentimes, you know, we don't even know what we're asking people to mentor us on, you know. And so I learned that from Maya Angelou, that it was, you know, she helped me when I was waiting tables. This was before my speaking career really took off, right? And before I, you know, wrote my book and all of that. And yet she hung in there and kept the connection going long enough so that I would be in a position where she could help me more, you know, and that's how I got a chance to interview her for my tech platform that I created to help African students get spotlighted to US admissions officials, universities. And she gave me 30 minutes of time in an interview. And I, you know, I wouldn't have gotten that, right, if I had sort of rushed the process a bit. So I think mentorship is really just, in my eyes, somebody who sees your potential oftentimes before you do, and invites you to stay connected, you know, as you figure out how you can best help them.
That's definitely the most interesting and profound definition of mentorship that I've heard. Somebody that believes in you even more than you believe in yourself. And one of the things that I take away from that, Sylvia, is that it's not something to be taken lightly. you know, let's spend some time figuring out what you need and what mentorship means to both of us, because I do think it's a term that we kind of throw around, and it deserves a certain level of respect, I think, that we owe to each other to define what this means and how we can help.
For sure.
So I'm really excited to dig into the emotional intelligence work you do. But before we do that, I was reacquainting myself with some content from Dr. Maya in preparation for this. And I've been talking to more and more people about their creative process. And she says, I had a big house, but she would have a hotel room and she would go there and she'd rent it for as long as she was there. And that would be her place where she would go and write and create. And she never slept there. It was just kind of like her office. And then she would go back to her big house, and she never did any of that creative work in her own home. And I'm wondering, what is your creative process like? And has that changed over, you know, the last 10 or 20 years, as long as you've been doing this?
Well, it certainly has changed as I've gotten a little wiser. But Bob, it's interesting that you share that story, because I smile because I stayed at that hotel that she's, it was called the Brookstown Inn in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I do remember that one day I was visiting her in Harlem, and she gave me, you know, a couple of hours of her time to talk through and answer any questions I had. And one of the things I was asking her was about her writing process. And then she would say that she went to the Brookstown Inn, and she would, because they knew her, they take all the things off the walls, right? Any, no distractions, paintings, carvings, everything comes out, and they leave her with a desk, a chair, lined piece of pad, paper, and a pen. And she would write and write and write. And once she interestingly said that, she said, Ms. Balfour, I, and she always called me by my last name, interestingly enough, but she said, I would sit there sometimes and write uninterrupted and nonstop for 8 hours, continuously writing, 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 writing. At the end of my writing, I would look at everything I had written and realize that I could only keep one sentence. And that's when she said to me, easy reading is damn hard writing. Because we often don't understand what an author goes through to bring a work to life, right? But the more we enjoy it, the harder it probably was for them to create it. And so my creative process has evolved to the point where my best friend when I'm trying to be creative is curiosity, not judgment. Judgment for me becomes an enemy. Curiosity is the best friend that I have sitting beside me in the creative process. And I found, especially in writing my book 4 years ago, that it really helped me, because I can be someone who self-edits and I'm so critical and just, you know, I interrupt my own creative process by being too judgmental. And by the way, I never do it in my office space either. I'm usually at a beach or in a beautiful garden or just somewhere out in nature. I need to be out in the beauty of nature or seeing it to really have the creative juices flowing, not looking at four walls, you know, of paint. And but I don't have a hotel room like her, but I do, you know, when I was writing my book, I would spend time, you know, in different beautiful places in Washington, D.C. And it's amazing how much writing I would get done, because I was just in nature, right? And just listen to the birds and just flowing. But curiosity is absolutely the friend that I must have beside me when I'm trying to be creative. Judgment is the enemy that I leave. I literally just visually close a door and leave judgment outside until I'm done.
I love that. Curiosity is the friend that you have with you. Yeah, judgment. I find that too. For one thing, I have to be outside, and it's my best ideas come when I tend to walk out in nature. But that idea of curiosity, I think, is really powerful, because I think what we often do, at least what I do, you know, you can see the guitars hanging on my wall behind me. I've never written a song, because I write one line and I'm like, oh, that sucks. That's terrible. I guess I'm just not a writer, right? And that, what you're saying, really resonates with me. I like that a lot.
Yeah. And Bob, just thinking about your guitar that I'm seeing behind you, for instance, I think that maybe one of the helpful questions we could ask ourselves to really keep curiosity, that best friend beside us, is to say something like, I'm curious about what I can achieve in the next 10 minutes just writing out some music. That just leads us one step at a time in front of the apprehension we might have or the perfectionism we may have.
I think that's powerful. I'm going to try that. And I will send you a note in a few days and let you know how it's turned out. I'll send you an audio clip of what I come up with.
There you go. And the point is to just do it, right? As opposed to doing it perfectly.
So let's talk about emotional intelligence. I was reflecting on this and I was thinking to myself, when's the first time I heard the term emotional intelligence? It's probably been so long that I don't remember. But in all the conversations that I've had, I don't remember ever talking about what it is or what people mean by it. And I think words matter because I don't think we're always talking about it in the same way. So what does it mean to you?
So I have a very succinct way of defining it for myself. And it's just, look, how aware are you of your own emotions at any given moment of the day? And how much do you care about the impact your emotions are having on you and the people around you? That's, to me, the most succinct definition of it. If I was being a little bit more long-winded in terms of how I share it with audiences, I would say that it's about recognizing and understanding your own emotions and the emotions of those around you, and then using that awareness to manage your decisions and interactions more effectively. But yeah, that's how I see it.
Yeah, if I'm honest, I don't know whether I would consider myself to be an emotionally intelligent person or not. That probably takes some more reflection. But if I'm honest and I broke down your definition into those two things, how aware am I and how much do I care? The second one, I would say, yeah, I do care a lot, but it's really interesting. I'm not sure that I've ever, I'm not sure I've ever thought about how being aware of my own emotions impacts that second part.
Yeah, you know, Jim Carrey, the comedian Jim Carrey, I think really said it wonderfully when he said, the effect you have on others is the most valuable currency there is. And I think it speaks to, you know, the effect you have on others is absolutely the most valuable currency, because if it's a good effect, you think about how your world opens up, what it invites into your space.
What do you think the biggest misconception about emotional intelligence is?
I would say the biggest misconception is that emotional intelligence is about being soft or being nice. I think that's huge. And it's the reason why I have so much resistance initially when I'm going to do presentations, especially for engineers, right? Or some of the really technically minded people. It's this, you know, in fact, I was doing a presentation, a keynote 2 weeks ago for some engineers. And you could see in the very beginning, as they were introducing me, there was this energy of, look, we've been excelling at what we do for 20, 30 years. So we don't need to learn emotional intelligence. And I think it's because of this notion that it's about being soft and about being nice. And it, you know, I say that emotional intelligence is not a skill you need when your life is perfect and when your relationships are firing on all cylinders. It is absolutely the skill set you need in those uncomfortable, inconvenient, and challenging moments of your lives, right? You don't need empathy when you're surrounded by a bunch of people who see the world the way you do. You need empathy for the person you can't understand or the person you don't agree with, and yet you still want to leave them with their humanity, you know, and agree to disagree, so to speak. So that to me is the most harmful misconception about it. It's not about being nice, because emotional intelligence is actually what helps us have those difficult conversations and do them in a way that gives us the best chance of the best outcome. It's, as you said, Bob, you know, words matter. And I often say that we have access to all of the words in the English language to use free of charge. But if we're not using our words mindfully, they can cost us a lot. And emotional intelligence is the skill set that allows us to choose words that are mindful enough to help us get to our ultimate goals, which at the end of the day is what we're all doing as we interact with people. So it's not about being soft. It's about having the difficult conversation, but doing it in a way that makes you effective, that doesn't put someone on the defensive. So EI has nothing to do with softness or shying away. And it's the reason I actually don't like to call it soft skill. I find myself cringing a little bit when I hear it. And I know we've all been trained to call it a soft skill. It's a human skill. It's a fundamental human skill.
That's interesting. And so in addition to public speaking, you do a lot of training. You know, if there were one or two things that you coach people on to move the needle on emotional intelligence, what do you tell them? I mean, maybe that's a ridiculous question. I'm sure it varies on by a number of different things, but What are some of those foundational things that you think most leaders need to get better at?
I think for one, leaders need to get better at emotional regulation on a fundamental level, because leaders are human beings, right? And we all have emotional triggers, and yet so few of us are intentional or intentionally aware of how we behave in those moments that we're triggered. And as a leader, if you aren't emotionally regulating, you are toxifying, if that's the word, you're polluting your team, your culture. And that's a big problem. So, you know, and I often talk about, I have this EI strategy that I call shifting phrases, which are generic phrases that help us buy a few seconds of time to calm down when we're emotionally charged so that we can bring our best selves the next moment. So emotional regulation is a big one, but the second one for leaders has to be empathy. Can I be in conversation with you in a way that allows you to feel seen and valued and heard, even if I have to disagree with you or make a hard decision? That's what affects so many work cultures, is leaders' inability to allow the people to feel seen and valued, and that sense of belonging. And that takes empathy, and that is a skill. It's so hard to empathize with people when you're not agreeing with them or when you don't understand them. And yet it's so necessary. Those are the moments in which we have to rise to the occasion and tap into our empathy skills with the words we use, our body language, and our listening. You know, are we listening more than we speak? And as we listen, are we listening with curiosity or with judgment and just sort of waiting our turn to talk?
There's a lot of wisdom in that. I was sort of reflecting as you mentioning that around triggers. What are the triggers that you had through this work that you've done that you need to be more aware of?
You know, I would say that maybe one that comes to mind is feeling criticized, right? I think it's an emotional trigger that most of us can connect with. Mm. It's not a good feeling to be criticized. And so I imagine that as I was getting deep into this work, that I would write posts or write an article that someone might not agree with in terms of my perspective, because I have a non-clinical approach to my emotional intelligence work. And so a trigger for me, you know, is feeling criticized. And yet one of the things I talk about with these shifting phrases is that when we are triggered emotionally, we always default to negative self-talk without even knowing it. And so the shifting phrase is really the positive self-talk that is designed to replace the negative. So instead of me in a moment where I feel criticized saying things like, oh, they don't know what the heck they're talking about, which is what I might feel like saying and what I probably say to myself in my head, I now pause and in adopt a shifting phrase like, is it possible they're seeing things from a different perspective, right? And all of a sudden, that emotional trigger isn't pushing me to do something irrational. You know, and I often talk about the fact that I believe that our emotional triggers will always be with us. That's the bad news. But the good news is that the way we manage and are impacted by those triggers is what can improve and change over time. So feeling criticized no longer pulls me into the zone of imposter syndrome and down some dark path, right? Because I'm using shifting phrases to center myself and open up curiosity, assume positive intent. And then we make room for others, right? That's how it happens.
Man, that is so interesting. I was, as you were talking about that, I think I've got that same trigger of being defensive, and you mentioned imposter syndrome, and that emotional regulation and empathy and listening just occurs to me that when somebody says something in a conversation and I feel that, I'm automatically not listening, right? Because I'm automatically thinking in my head, I get defensive. And as you mentioned, so they are so connected, and you've got to be able to either turn that conversation in your head around or park it or distance yourself to stay present in the conversation to actually make space and be present like you want to be.
It totally does. And that's why to me, shifting phrases are so important. And the reason I use the term shifting phrase, because I think about how it shifts your energy, your mindset in those few seconds, you know. And on stage, I often, and I apologize to him in advance, Will Smith, but I often use him as an example to say that, you know, that fateful slap that was heard around the world at the Oscars a couple of years ago, you know, a shifting phrase could really have helped him, because no matter what triggered him in that moment, if instead of saying, you know, just believing that it was that was meant to offend him and his wife or whatever the case might be, if he had adopted a shifting phrase like, hey, is it possible Chris did not mean to offend my wife, right? That wouldn't have created a situation where he's storming 11 steps the stage to slap Chris Rock. He could have said, is it possible this is all part of a skit? And I guarantee those sorts of questions do not then invite the most violent reactions within us. It just doesn't, because we're assuming positive intent until we know more. And when he knows more, he might pull him backstage and have a civil conversation with him, right? And so, like I said, you know, this is all the stuff we need to be doing that's happening when we're uncomfortable and we're challenged, right? Emotional intelligence is a skill we can throw out when we're perfect, which is never.
Yeah. And if Will Smith is anything like me, you know, somebody cuts me off in traffic and I give him the finger, fortunately, you know, it doesn't happen nearly as much anymore, but I don't know whether that's because I've matured or whether I just don't drive as much because I work from home all the time. But it just happens. Like it's hardwired, subconscious. It happens so fast. And immediately right after, I feel like the biggest asshole in the world. Like, oh my God, what is wrong with me? I'm a grown man giving some teenager a finger because he, you know, cut me off. And it's just so, it always strikes me, as you mentioned it, how the triggers automatically create something negative. It's always really interesting to me that what comes naturally is imposter syndrome and comparison and anxiety. Like if we take our hands off the wheel, that's where we end up. It just seems ass backwards that all this stuff that we aspire to do and we really associate with being a better person, it takes work. I don't think my parents ever thought about that. I didn't realize being an adult took all this work and thought. So to that point, are there daily habits? Are there small things that you think people can do to become either to regulate their emotions or be more empathetic, to increase their emotional intelligence sort of little by little as we build that muscle?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the foundational ones is for us to do what I call mind your monologue. You know, you just think about it every so often throughout the day, especially when you're getting a little heated internally, just to stop and say, am I minding my monologue? You know, it's a question I ask myself a few times a day, which is, am I in control of my self-talk in this moment? Because when things aren't going right, it's the first thing that escapes us. It leaves out of the window, out of the door, it's gone. That's definitely a habit that I take on. Every so often, I just stop and say, hey, Sylvia, you're minding your monologue. But the other one I think would have to be around what I just talked about earlier, which is this concept of emotional aftertaste. If we develop a habit of better influencing how people feel once they leave our presence, not control, right? Because we can't control how others feel about us, and it's not our business to control that. But it absolutely is our business to influence that. And so one of the daily habits is to think about one dominant emotion you would like someone to feel by the time you're done interacting with them, whether it's the mailman, the person helping you bag your groceries, right? Your boss in that difficult conversation you have to have. If you can think about one emotion you would like them to feel by the time they leave your presence, it is absolutely going to start impacting the way you communicate, your body language. So, Bob, if I want you to feel inspired by the time we're done with this conversation, I guarantee you, it's influencing how I'm presenting my ideas. If I don't care about how I want you to feel, I could talk any kind of way, right? If I want someone to feel hopeful and inspired, even after a difficult performance evaluation I've got to give them, it's going to absolutely influence the words I use in presenting, not to be too soft and tippy-toe around the tulips, but it will make me more mindful of how I'm interacting with you, which is going to help ensure I have the best chance of leaving behind a sweet emotional aftertaste as opposed to a sour one. So those are two, I think, more tangible habits, right? Is, can you wake up in the morning and ask yourself once in the day, am I minding my monologue? Can you, in one interaction you have in the day, think in advance of the interaction, what is one emotion you'd like this person to feel by the time they're done, by the time they leave your presence? And I think someone who's doing even those two things on a daily basis is going to be experienced in a way that, you know, I often tease that, you know, are you someone, do people crave your presence or do they crave your absence? you know? And if you are minding your monologue and if you are influencing the, you care about the emotional aftertaste you leave behind, then you're somebody that people probably crave to be around, which is what we all want. We all want people to be drawn to us, not repelled. At least that's what I hope.
I love that a lot. The other thing you mentioned too, as you're sharing that, is like a lot of people, I spend, you know, I'm probably in on average 5 or 6 Zoom meetings a day. And I wonder what difference it would make if I just took, instead of jumping from call to call, like I sometimes do, spending a couple of minutes before every call, just giving more thought to how I want that person to feel at the end of that conversation, setting that intention and seeing how that changes just the tone and the language that I use. That is something I'm going to try. I love that idea.
That makes me happy to hear.
That great thing about having a podcast is, see, now that I've said it, I kind of have to do it. It's not just something that I tell myself or write down on this
exactly.
piece of paper that nobody's going to know if I do or not.
Exactly. We're putting your feet to the fire here, Bob.
One of the things that we talked about in that first conversation, you were sharing kind of your journey around public speaking. And this is something that I've toyed with myself. I've thought about whether it's something that I want to do someday. And you were talking about how long you'd been doing it. I'd love to hear, what advice do you have for people that are thinking about doing this maybe someday?
You know, I think looking back at the 19 years or so that I've been doing this, the most important advice I would give people is understand why you're doing it. Because you may have heard this term before, the privilege of the platform. You know, think about the opportunity you have, the rare opportunity to be in front of an audience and have them shut up for 30 to 40 to 60 minutes and listen to you. That is a privilege. Not many of us get that kind of mass airtime, you know, from people we don't even know. It is absolutely a privilege. And so you have to understand why you're up there in the first place. It's a fine line, the business I'm in, because we can have a lot of egos. You know, look at me, I'm up on stage sharing my story. And so one of the things I say is, even as you're developing your content to go and deliver it in front of 2 people or 100 people or 1,000 people, as you're developing that content, every 4 to 5 sentences, stop and ask yourself the question, why should they care? Meaning your audience. And if you cannot answer that question, then you are rambling on, you're on a pedestal, you are talking too much about yourself, you are not connecting, you are not relating, you're missing the mark. Because the goal of being a public speaker or sharing anything publicly in terms of a speech is to impact and influence, right? To change minds, to influence the way people feel and think and behave. And in order for that to happen, you have to help them care about what you're saying. So understand why you're doing what you do. Is it for good intentions, or is it just so you can share your glamour story of overcoming? You know, because we all have stories of overcoming. But why should I care to give you 5 to 10 to 15 to an hour of my time to listen? It is an absolute privilege. And so if people can start out with that foundation, not taking it for granted, then success is really yours. And you'll be received in exactly the way you hoped you would, which will help your nerves.
And I think you said one time, any speaking you do outside your house is public speaking. You know, I probably butchered that saying. You probably said it much better than I did. But it's interesting. If I apply that definition, I think there's a lot of wisdom in really thinking, even in the conversations that I have with clients or even friends and family, every 4 or 5 sentences, ask yourself, why would they care? Am I talking about something that I'm just rambling and there's really no message or value in it for people? I think that would be really helpful for me to think about.
I mean, you think about the most electrifying speech you heard, a TEDx talk or whatever, and I bet you if you go back and think through it every so often, that person makes you care. You personally, and the ones that are boring and we're like breathing steam on our knuckles, you know, enduring it, it's because they are just on a pedestal. And not maliciously, I'm not saying it's always, you know, ill-intentioned, but we need to care. You know, you don't, it's not every day you get people keeping quiet and listening to you for X number of minutes. And so challenging ourselves is to keep answering that question will ensure that we are being as effective as we can as presenters.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about, so if people are thinking about doing this, because honestly, you know, you and I met at a public speaking event, and it was enlightening for me because I really didn't know much about the business. What do you think the biggest misconception that people have about public speaking is, or the life?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that the person that you think is so dynamic and enjoyable on stage is doing so without any nerves, without any apprehension, right? That they just arrive at this place of perfection, you know? And the reality is even the most seasoned speakers out there have some nerves. I think what is cool is that we learn how to channel the nerves in a way that's productive as opposed to harmful. And, you know, I once heard, to me, the most profound way this was put, and I heard it from Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love. I think she was getting ready to do a talk on Oprah's stage for one of Oprah's events. And it's something I use because essentially what she was saying, and I'm not going to be saying it perfectly, but she said that she came to the realization that every single human being sitting in those seats in front of her has come there with their own anxieties and their own insecurities and their own trepidation. And so it was not her job to impart her own anxiety and insecurity on this audience. That was not her job, is to add to what they already are grappling with in their own private lives, you know? And that is something that really centers me. You know, I think about it, everybody sitting in my audience has their own anxieties and insecurities. What they do not need from me investing their time is to have me add to that with my own, you know? And so it allows me to focus on the matter at hand. The people in the seats in front of you want you to do well because selfishly, it allows them to have a good time. Mm-hmm. No one is there waiting for you to fail. And that is so much of what's behind our nervousness. You know, what if I look bad, make a fool of myself? The bare bones reality is that even at a comedy show, right, I want you to make me laugh. I don't want to catch you in some boring, weird, awkward moment. I want to laugh so hard my stomach hurts by the time I leave. And so we realize that the people who are listening to us most of the time are rooting for our rise. And if we can really channel that, I think that helps a lot. So the misconception is that the seasoned people don't have nerves or butterflies. And that's not the case, because if you care about doing a good job, you're going to have some butterflies, but it's how you allow them to take flight, you know, that makes a difference.
That's amazing. What do you love most about it?
The opportunity to impact others, you know, and I know that can sound a little cliche, but it's funny because when I was a little girl, my parents would tease me a lot because I was very shy. I was a painfully shy girl. I mean, really painfully shy. And to the point where if you were standing on my foot, for instance, it was easier for me to just have you leave it there and move it when you would than for me to bring attention to the fact that you had your foot on mine, you know? But within my little household with my parents and my two brothers, you couldn't stop me from talking. I mean, and my father would always say, you know, Sylvia, you talk so much. When you talk, don't you get tired? You know, and I'd always tease. I said, someday I'm going to grow up and keep running my mouth for a living. You know, I didn't quite knew how it would manifest, but because I love the opportunity to take care with my thoughts and articulate them in a way that can be helpful to somebody out there. That feels so meaningful to me. And I don't know what corner of the earth it's going to happen, right? I do presentations. I remember once I was doing a presentation and there was a gentleman sitting in the front row with his arms crossed and I couldn't read him. I couldn't tell if he was bored, if he was angry. And at the end of my talk, he came up to me. There were a few people lined up and he said, Sylvia, the story you told at the beginning of your presentation, and it was a story about putting things in perspective. So from that moment when he heard the story, he was just thinking through his own life. And he said, I've been faced for the last 9 months with a very difficult decision about whether to check my dear mother into a nursing home. And he was an only child. And he said that having been here for the last 60 minutes has given me the peace of mind, the clarity I need to make the decision. And he didn't tell me what the decision was, but you could see a lifting And here I was judging this man for crossing his arms and looking at me in a way that I interpreted as weird and awkward, right? And so we don't know where people are going to, you know, where the impact comes from, right? And so that's what I enjoy. Every opportunity for me to be on stage or to do a training or to even have a coaching experience, you know, I don't know the impact I'm going to have. And that's exciting because it reminds me to take what I do seriously.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. I imagine you must hear some pretty powerful things, you know, to the left of the stage where people come and talk to you afterwards. You must hear some pretty powerful stories from people about what they're taking away from those speeches you give.
Absolutely. And it's what keeps me going and keeps me doing what I do.
So final question, what now? What are you most excited about?
I'm excited about a signature keynote presentation that I am close to finishing. And Bob, you'll appreciate this because this came from the workshop that we both attended. And I hired a speech coach to sort of help me take all the stuff I do best on stage and kind of bring it together in a signature talk. And so I'm really excited to see how that comes together in the next couple of months. And it's really about navigating the streets of your life with emotional intelligence, because every experience, every interaction we have is literally happening in the streets of our lives every day. And what are we carrying in our emotional backpacks to ensure that we're not just surviving, but we're thriving both personally and professionally. And that's really what the talk is all about. So I'm very excited about that. And my hope is that it will parlay into a book in the fall if I maintain the focus. So those are things that are exciting me right now.
That's amazing. As you're sitting in a park in Washington, D.C., you know, refining this speech and writing this book. And yeah, I love that imagery of navigating the streets with this. I imagine myself navigating the streets of life with this probably pretty heavy backpack that I'm lugging around with all these biases and stories and self-doubts and all this shit that most of us carry around with us most of the time.
Yeah, and being able to unload that backpack and have things in there that are actually going to serve us and make us enjoyable to be around.
Yeah, I can put good things in the backpack is what you're saying. I hadn't even thought of that.
Absolutely.
Sylvie, I can't thank you enough. You know, I can look back on my life and there's a small number of people that I always aspired to be a bit more like. And they were people that, if I had to sum it up, were people that made me feel like the most important person in the room. And I can look back and think of a small handful of these people over my career. And I always aspire to be that person. I think I've got a long way to go, but you've certainly, in that dinner conversation where we had, you certainly made me feel that way. This conversation has been amazing. There are no less than a dozen things I'm going to take away from it and try to apply to my life. And I'm just so grateful for the time that you've given me today. It's meant the world to me.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's been a privilege. I'm grateful for the opportunity. You know, it's when you hear from others how you impact them, that's when it's most meaningful, right? It's not us trying to toot our own horns and say that we are X, Y, and Z. So it means a lot for me to hear that that is the way you experience me. And it shows me that the way I live on stage is the way I'm trying to live off stage. And it's nice to know that that's coming through. So thank you for the opportunity and hope your listeners get something fun out of this.
I'm sure they will. And I guess I owe you an audio clip of a couple lines of a song that I'm going to write. So prepare your ears for that.
You absolutely do. And I'm waiting. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you. The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.